Hello and welcome to another episode of the Audaciousness Podcast with me, Maribel Ortega.
And me, Helen Strong. In this podcast, we showcase individuals who have set themselves bold and audacious goals and have worked to achieve them with the aim of inspiring others to also set themselves audacious goals and to create a positive movement in the world.
We'd like to highlight the fact that even regular people like you and me can have audacious goals, and that role models are, in fact, all around us. Each and every one of us can have an impact in some way.
Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have you with us. So, Maribel, tell us about the guest we're going to hear from today.
Yes, it's a pleasure for me to introduce our conversation that you'll be listening to in a few minutes with Mark Matamisa, who is a professional who lives in South Africa, but originally from Zimbabwe. I met him online in the MBA that I'm doing, and he came forward with the project that he will be talking about. I thought just the first conversation I had with him was so moving and inspiring that I was convinced we had to have him on our show.
Great. So we listen to the interview with Mark now, and then we'll come back in half an hour to talk about what we learned. So here's Mark. We hope you enjoy the interview.
Thanks very much, Mark, for agreeing to having a conversation with us. I was really looking forward to listening to your story. So for our listeners, could you just briefly tell us who you are and what your audacious goal was?
Well, still is. I'm Mark Matamisa. I'm based in Cape Town, South Africa, but originally from Zimbabwe. I've been in South Africa since 2005, and I've made this my home, you know, without ever losing contact or touch with what's going on in Zimbabwe. And it's the biggest part of my life, you know, and that's what kind of drives me. And the audacious goal that I found myself, I can't say it's something that I set out to develop, but it's something that actually came out organically out of a group of friends that I had. And our goal ended up being to provide an alternative source of treated, good-tasting water to a group that we felt was greatly underserved. Yeah, that developed from, it came up from in 2008 when I went back home during my December holidays. I arrived there during the peak of the 2008 Zimbabwe cholera outbreak. And it was a very trying time. You know, there were many reports, you know, in South Africa were asking people not to travel to Zimbabwe or to travel there with a lot of precautions, pretty much like what's happening now with the coronavirus and COVID-19. And there were high case fatality rates in excess of 5%, which wasn't the norm for a cholera outbreak. But what you found was that the outbreak, from a UN report, it was traced to there having been a breakdown in the portable water and sanitation systems, which led to contamination of drinking water sources. And that gave rise to conditions that made the outbreak occur and become worse than it should have been at any other time in Zimbabwe's history.
So what made you decide that you were going to be the one to deal with this, Mark?
Well, it wasn't me per se, you know. I had come together with four friends of mine, and we had started a savings club where every month we'd put in a portion of our income and set it aside and hopefully grow it into something bigger, you know, because the way our financial services structure is structured here is that if you deposit a certain number of money, you get a higher interest rate. And the more the money you deposit in the interest-bearing account, the higher the interest rate you get. So we felt that, you know, let's combine our savings so that we can put in one saving instead of five different small amounts. We can save one big amount every single month. And in that way, take advantage of the system, as it were. But, you know, when we started this, one of the guys then said, you know, but guys, you know, we're getting a little bit of interest, but there's definitely opportunity for us to do something more that will give us a higher profitability, because the interest rates they never really exceeded 6%. And we wanted to get a bit more growth. And so in those talks then, and trying to find a business that we could start, you know, one of my friends had gone home and just came back and said, guys, there's a water problem in Zimbabwe. Could that be something we can tackle? You know, because the market is there. And if we can develop a product that works, we just might be able to make an enterprise that is profitable and also do some good while we're at it. So that was where we started. And that's how the goal developed.
So was it important that the enterprise had to be profitable? I mean, you said there's two things. You're thinking of it with your business head, and your friend who came back said, this is a profitable business that we can run. I'm just wondering what was the balance between we need to do good for our people and we need to make money for ourselves. I wonder if you could say something about that.
It was definitely... Look, when we started this enterprise, we wanted to make some money. And when we looked at it, we felt this could be something that could be profitable. But I don't think the profit line was the driving motivation. The profit was a driving motivation to our earlier iterations. I think you're familiar with the entrepreneurial journey. You know, you start something, but that's not where you ever end up. So we never actually started looking at a water project in our minds. We did some bit of consultancy. We did business development for other people. We would put suppliers and the customers together and make commission off that. And that's where we started. And going on from there, this idea came up. So, you know, the projects that we've been doing were very small. But in the scale, they created, you know, a big opportunity to get a profit, because they were low cost. There were no overheads, you know, other than our time that were involved. And then all of a sudden, we moved into, let's build infrastructure to get water to a community. And the minute you're talking infrastructure, that becomes cost intensive. You know, it's capital intensive. You need to put something on the ground before you can do anything. And to me, it spoke volumes of the character of the guys that I was involved with, because they were willing to go and put themselves out there and put their savings out there. And we are not by any stretch of the imagination well off, or people with excess resources. We're literally working off the little savings that we can that come out of our salaries and that our family is able to do without, as it were. So it's definitely a sacrifice on the part of our families, because we've asked them to cut back a few things. But once we started, it was very difficult to stop. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I understand. Where are you right now then? Can you say a little bit about what is the infrastructure? How many people are you reaching? What impact have you had?
We went live going into the COVID lockdowns, because it took some time developing the infrastructure, getting systems in place and processes that would actually make this work. And by the time we finished, I think we were March to April 2020, which was when the lockdowns took effect on this side of the world. And so you didn't have a lot of foot traffic that we had anticipated, but what we did do is we said, guys, we can't stop developing this because of the lockdown. People need water regardless, whether they're allowed to go to work or play. They're going to. It's something that people need. So we set that up, but we only got our billing system up and running in December 2020, and so before then, there was a water. We call them our water kiosks. We had set up our water kiosk, our first water kiosk, where we're testing the viability of the project. And that was up and running, but it was actually just almost water for free because there was no way for us to bill for it. But when one of our members, who's a water engineer, then went up to Zimbabwe, he was able to then set up the whole system. So at the current point, I think we have in excess of 50 to 80 families that are making use of our water kiosk. And that number is indicative of the market we're trying to reach, because we put in a capital outlay. So we can't give the water at the prices that the city council would sell water for if it was available. It is available, but sometimes it isn't. And what we found in our market research was that there were NGOs within the area that were providing water to people for next to nothing. You know, it's just, you know, give us a token and you can have water as much as you need. But then what we found was that there were limitations to when that water was available. It could be only 2 hours a day. It could be during specific times. And you had a lot of working people, either working for themselves or working in informal industries, who could not make those times and actually would have benefited from having access to a 24-hour station where they can come and collect their water at any time that they wish. And that became the focus of our marketing and our engineering of our product. So now that it's on the ground, we're finding that, you know, every week we get two or three new families that come in and buy our tokens and join the product. And what we do make available to them is access to 5,000 liters of water, treated water, which is very good tasting because it's got carbon filtration. And it's magnitudes better than just getting water down from the borehole, which isn't treated, which isn't filtered. And at the same time, it's accessible to you whenever you want it, as long as you have an electronic tagging system that you can use to access your water credits and the like. But for those that don't have those, because we've sited our initial site at a fuel station in partnership with Puma Fuels, who run a string of fuel stations in Zimbabwe. Because the forecourt is always open, there's always somebody to assist people who come in. And that has been one of the best strategic decisions that we've made in partnerships. And I'd like to really thank the guys at Puma for agreeing to take the leap to work with a group of untested 30-something-year-olds and try and put this out in the community.
That sounds amazing. I think this project is fantastic. And I would like to come back to something that you told me when we had our first conversation, which is related to the emotional connection that is there. And I have the feeling that that is the driving force why those 30-something guys are willing to do this and use their own savings into this. Remember you told me about going back to Zimbabwe, and what is it that you saw there?
Well, that's a very difficult place for taking me to. In 2008, when I went back, when the cholera outbreak occurred, my mother, who was very active in the community, took me to one of the treatment centers, the temporary treatment centers that were erected in my hometown. And because of the magnitude of the outbreak, the hospitals didn't have sufficient capacity to treat people that were coming in. So they had to set up temporary treatment centers through the Ministry of Child Health and Child Welfare and some UN assistance. And, you know, when my mom took me to the center, I was aware that there was a problem and that people needed help. But when I got there, what I encountered was nothing that I could imagine. It was a really desperate situation where I actually couldn't bring myself to get to the treatment center. So I drove my mom there and I left her at the gate and I went and I parked away. You could smell the desperation it really affected me, I can say. You know, it's one of those things, one of those times in my life that I really wished that there was something that I could do. Back then, there was nothing I could do. You know? And 10 years down the road, this opportunity presented itself and we had to get in. I'm sorry. It's a difficult moment.
Definitely. So you said that at that moment you saw the desperation of the situation and you felt and this is my word, helpless. Would that be the word, that you felt helpless in the situation? How long then did it take you, would you say, before this vision appeared as to how you could actually do something in order to remedy this situation?
And I don't think that we actually ever went out to try and remedy the situation, because that's such a lofty goal. It's huge.
Mm.
There's no way we could start it and finish it. But leaving there, I wanted to do something, but I couldn't. And when we started this this investment club with my friends, and one of the founders was an engineer, a water engineer in particular, he has wonderful ideas around water. He can't understand why it's not available to everyone who needs it. His passion and his drive and his expertise in the field really drove the rest of us and gave us confidence that we can actually do something. You know, it might be small, but it would be something. And the UN in their assessment of the 2008 cholera outbreak actually said that the only reason why the fatalities were as high as they were, that it was 2008 to 2009 period where the outbreak really wreaked havoc, was because there was an unavailability of clean water, and that contributed to people's failure to make use of oral rehydration solutions. Now, growing up, my parents were teachers, and we knew if you've got diarrhea or cholera, mom is going to make a salt and sugar solution. I don't need to go to the hospital for that. I don't need to go to the clinic, because we've got clean water coming out of the taps, or she'll boil some water and make salt and sugar solution. And that was how we treated these things. And for a lot of the people who perished during that time, the reason they perished was because they weren't getting access to that very simple treatment or option at the start of their symptoms. And doctors have been saying this about COVID as well, that people who get treated quicker are more likely to recover, especially those who have extreme conditions. And so their not being clean water became a driving force for us to say, let's make some water available. It's complicated when you try and provide the whole city with water. But if you say, look, let's focus on this one community, let's give them clean water. Let's treat it, because the treatment, the water treating process on a small scale is not expensive. You know, there are solutions that have been there, that have been developed by, you know, and been available for many years, where you put, I'm not sure what the concentration is, but you've got a 5,000 liter tank of water. If you put some tablets in there to disinfect that water, then that water is available for drinking, and people can know that they won't get sick from that water. As long as the infrastructure is maintained, they can use that, you know, with some sort of confidence. And that's sort of where we came from. I think I've gotten lost from your question.
No, another question actually, which is coming up for me is, I mean, this is obviously a huge goal that you know, you're saying here that we just wanted to get clean water to these people. It's obviously a huge, huge goal. I'm interested in what challenges you were facing, you know, as a private individual, feeling that you needed to do this because, you know, the NGOs or the state was failing the people. So what challenges were you facing in that respect? And also, how easy was it to get other people on board with your idea as a private enterprise?
Well, I think once we decided to go on this route, a key question became, where do we start? You know, where do we put our first site? Because, you know, Zimbabwe is a big country, and each part of that country needs some water, you know, to different levels. So where do you put your first site, and how do you ensure that that site is accessible to people, to the community you want to serve, and that the infrastructure that you put will be safe, while ensuring that, you know, you can give people 24-hour access. And then the other thing that we had was, can we find the technology that works? Because it's all well and fine, you know, putting a tank in the middle of nowhere and putting water in it, but how do you make that into a product that generates value? How do we stock that, you know, the tank with water? How do we ensure that it doesn't run out, or that the pipes don't foul and the water becomes undrinkable or even a hazard? How do we guarantee that we will get buy-in from the community? Because, you know, when you're dealing with issues like with social issues, they're very challenging. Yes, the community needs a service, but you cannot assume that because you think that the product that you have will be good for people, that everybody in that community will be happy that you've brought it there. I think after we went live with our media and our marketing, some of the criticism that we got on our social media platforms was quite eye-opening. You know, I think there were things that we had never ever thought, where people were questioning why we as an entity felt that we could charge somebody else money for water. It was something that we never considered, because, like I said, the project arose organically, you know, out of our shared experiences. You know, others would call it a vanity project. You know, here are people who are outsiders, being not based in the country, who have chosen to do a project to make themselves feel good and raise their profiles. It's quite challenging managing those perceptions, you know, where we were just, you know, a group of people that wanted to serve other people like ourselves, who just lacked the organizational capacity and resources. Indeed. To bring clean water to the community.
And how did you respond to those criticisms?
What became the message was that the infrastructure that we're developing is not free. We do not have unlimited pockets, and we aren't funded by anybody. This is entirely a self-funded enterprise. And so we need, at the end of the day, to be able to go to our families and say, guys, you know, we're not throwing away what little money that we've saved as a family. Think of it as an investment. It's not something that's going to generate money for you tomorrow. You're not going to become a millionaire from it today. But it's something that if we can make work, it will help people who actually need it. And if there's enough traffic and need for it, then we can recoup our investment. And I think at this point, that is the driving force for the project. You know, if we're fortunate, we'll recoup our investment. We won't make money on this. Because our projections were that within the next 3 to 5 years, the city should be providing water to all the communities that are within it. This is a local government issue. This is something that they should do for the people. And so we're not going to be doing this for 20 years. We don't want to do it for 20 years, because doing it for 20 years will mean that something has fundamentally failed. And we don't believe that things cannot be fixed and that the city can't come and provide access to clean water dependably. As you said, Maribel, we stay in societies where water is a given. It's not something that we think about. You know? Mm-hmm. You go and you open the tap and there's water. I've now had two different situations where you had a collapsed water infrastructure in Zimbabwe that has caused failure for people to get water. And I've also experienced the day zero concept that we in Cape Town were grappling with over the last 2 years, where all our dams were going empty. We had a massive drought and there was no water, not because the infrastructure has failed, not because the city has failed, but because climate has changed and the droughts are becoming more severe. And so you have to be positive. You have to be positive. I feel that things will come right and there will be no need for our project. And on that day, you know, that will be a happy day.
That's beautiful. Like, I wanted to ask you what the vision is, but I think you've already, what the vision is that you're looking for, because the need of something like this to take place, of a project like this, just means that society lives in huge differences. I'm assuming that there are people who, like us in the where we live, don't think about whether there will come water or not, and others where that's a dilemma for each day.
Yeah, that's quite true. And unfortunately, we can't serve the most desperate in the situation because we can't afford to. We can't afford to give away our money, our water indefinitely. And that's what has driven us to put a price on access to our water facilities. But in the community where we are, there are NGOs that do provide water and do cater to those that are literally on the fringes and require that help. We've toyed often about the idea of making it a fully social enterprise, where if we had the backers and we had the funds, we could literally go into communities and set these kiosks up and run them as a social service, knowing that, you know, the capital outlay has been taken care of by some other party. But it's very difficult to come across those opportunities, because we're not in that line of work. I mean, we're not affiliated with any NGOs. And yeah, we're just a group of friends who like doing what we do. And I think that the biggest thing that has come out of this for us is that this is the first big project that we've done. And the lessons that we have learned, we could not have gotten them anywhere else. There are many entrepreneurs who are starting for-profit businesses who go into market with rose-tinted glasses. And I think that was us when it began. And we have learned through this, you know, the many iterations that we've gone through, that one needs to be realistic and one needs to understand the market and the community they're going into. Because unless you do that, whatever you're providing is not really for the market, but it's actually for you. And that is a vanity project. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we're trying to do.
Our final question is connected with the name of our podcast, Audaciousness. And the word ness in that word means solid grounding. So what we would like to know is, while you were and still are pursuing your goal, where do you get that solid grounding to continue and persevere regardless of everything else that is in motion around you?
That's a very good question. Personally, my wife has been the solid ground that has permitted me to continue pursuing this goal. For many people, solid ground comes from having answers and being subject matter experts. But I've realized that having my wife as a sounding board throughout has given me the peace of mind to understand that the courses of action that we've taken and the compromises that we've been forced to take to enable the realization of our goals don't take away from the value that we've created and the provision of the water that we've managed to achieve in a community in need. And that value created is a very fickle thing. I think as an American psychologist, Stephen Stosny said, you know, a sunset only has value if only we invest time and effort to appreciate it. So if we take the time to appreciate the little that we've done and achieved in a relatively small space of time, I think we have some reason to be happy and some reason to think that we will achieve our goal in full.
That's beautiful.
That's lovely, Mark. Thank you so much.
And thank you guys for inviting me to your podcast to discuss. It's a very emotive issue.
Obviously, I can feel that coming from you, and I wish you all the best in your project. And like you say, I hope you, how can I say this? I hope you fail in your project, in that the people who should be doing this, i.e. the state, do take this over and provide the much needed water to the population, which they should be doing.
Oh, thank you. Accept that.
Would that be the greatest success, being forced to close your kiosks because the community and the government is providing clean
water? That would definitely be the greatest success. Yeah, that's the gold standard of water provision. You know, this is a public good. It's a human right. It should be accessible to anyone and everybody. And it shouldn't be, no one should be priced out of the market and of access to clean water. And I think failure to have it removes a lot of people's dignity, and it puts societies in very desperate situations.
Thank you so much for sharing this. This has been a very powerful conversation, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
This was one of our more emotional interviews, Maribel, and I know that straight after this call, after Mark left the room, you talked about what he was saying resonating with you because of where you grew up. And I just couldn't relate to not having access to clean drinking water, having only lived really in the UK and Germany in my life, where it's a given that you turn on the tap and clean water comes out. So I wonder if you could say something about how access to water was for you growing up in the Dominican Republic, Maribel, and what you were feeling during this conversation.
It was a moving conversation to me, precisely because I had seen it. I can say that I was fortunate that I didn't have to be in the situation of the people that Mark described, because in my country, then it would mean it's extreme poverty you are into. But what I did have myself growing up is, for example, knowing that you shouldn't drink tap water, because tap water is not drinkable, because you can get a stomach bug or something worse. So I grew up knowing that you have to buy drinking water. So you have to pay for it. That's a service. So it's even a market there. And the other thing that I also grew up with, living on a fourth floor apartment, was that when I was a child, teenager, there were lots of electricity went out. That meant there's no water to take a shower. So we had some gallons that were always there in case there's no electricity, so that you can somehow take a shower. So actually that allowed me and everyone at that time, that with 1 gallon of water, you were able to find the best position that you would put the water coming out, and then it would touch your shoulder, and then from that it would wet the rest of your body. Mm. So that you use the least water absolutely necessary so that you could have a shower. And actually it's something that now where I'm living is I'm trying to not use too much warm water. And I just remember back, oh, that was you can't use too much, because with this gallon of water, me and my brother have to take a shower. Otherwise you would have to go down and get something from the water cistern, and that's too much work. You don't want that. The other way to answer specifically your question, Helen, that I had a lot of access to seeing that kind of extreme, appalling poverty was because during my time living there in the Dominican Republic, I was a med student. So as a med student, you are taken with doctors to very poor parts of the city, where you see how people live and you see children and the way these houses are. There's no tap water. There's just not water. They have to go somewhere to go get water. And when I was listening to him, I just remembered small brown boys, very, very skinny. You could see their bones, arms and legs, and this huge expanded belly full of worms and just the skin very dry because it's so hot and they just don't have enough. That's what I was thinking when he was speaking.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, going back to what you said about the shower, I do have a timer in my shower. I have a 4-minute timer to remind myself to save water as well. And I'm very conscious of water. And one of the reasons that I moved to Scotland 2 years ago was because, I'd been living in Germany for 20 years and I had the feeling that even in Germany, the summers were getting hotter and drier. I don't know if you've noticed that still as well. And I was genuinely worried about access to water in the future. So that was a major deciding factor for me to move to the west coast of Scotland, where there's still plenty of rain. Even in parts of England, there are sometimes water shortages. And I find that really concerning about the future. I'm just so conscious of you need to get access to clean drinking water. What he was saying about the water tasting good and actually wanting to drink the water, that you turn on the tap and it's like, oh no, I don't want to drink this water. Earlier this year, I watched a documentary called Secret of Water. And I'll put a link to the film in the show notes. And they were demonstrating, and I didn't know this, this is all new for me, that water has memory. And that it conveys information. It conveys the information that it's captured on its journey. It conveys that information into our DNA when we drink it or when we absorb it through our skin. And apparently, if we treat water well and with respect, then it retains more of its nutritional and healing qualities. And treating water well means allowing it to do what it does naturally, which is to flow rapidly over rocks and moss and bounce off rocks and so on. Mm. Whereas if we treat water badly And by badly, what it said in the film was pumping it through straight metal pipes, you know, pumping it through, firstly through metal, and secondly that the pipes are straight so that it doesn't, you know, bounce all over the place like it does over rocks. Mm-hmm. And then when we drink that water or we water our plants with it, it doesn't have as many nutrients or positive qualities anymore. So we're actually drinking water which is in effect dead, it loses its life. And another thing which I found fascinating in the film was they even showed that playing a certain type of classical music to a glass of water had a positive impact on the molecules. The crystals in the water were bouncing. You know, depending on what the music was that you were playing. So it's a fascinating documentary, and I'd really recommend watching it.
Okay. Helen. Okay, I'll watch it. You have convinced me, and see the dancing water. If it makes it taste better. Indeed, having good tasting water is something important. And the type of water that you drink in the Dominican Republic that you buy, that tastes like nothing. Mm-hmm. That's almost distilled water, you know? That doesn't taste good. And yeah.
I can understand it now because, you know, when you buy, I mean, my big issue is buying carrots from the supermarket just tastes like nothing whatsoever compared to the carrots that you've grown in your garden. Mm. I never thought about water in that way until I saw this film, but it makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. They say that the water here in this area has lots of caulk and that it's doesn't taste that good. Some people say that, but you know what? I think it tastes very good. And also knowing, you know, the river that crosses through this city in Munich, you just see that crystal water. That has to be good for you. One other topic that is related to having access to drinking water, and that also we talked about it with Mark, is government and mm-hmm. politics. Because these guys, Mark and his colleagues, friends, they're doing this. But this is just an emergency project. I mean, that's what I concluded. And when I think we all agreed, this is the responsibility of the government. And many years ago, I watched a video. We can also put that link in the show notes. And it's, why are some countries rich? And why are other countries poor? And why are they always the same? And the main reason for some countries being rich and other poor is temperature. When the mean or the average temperature is around 15, 16 degrees, then those countries, you can predict that they will be rich because of agriculture, because if your mean temperature is 16, 15 degrees, you probably will not have droughts. And also then you will have probably different seasons, colder seasons. And one thing, another topic that was important was in governments, like for example, in Africa, but also in Latin America, there is in the society a way of a tribal thinking. That means that whoever is in power, then they bring people who are part of their tribe, so people that they know, into the boat so that they can share that wealth. That means that you do not pick the best person to do a particular job, but you pick the person that is the cousin of your whatever, or the husband of your sister, or I don't know. So that makes things, so that's kind of like, and I know it from my country that it's like that. Mm. But in the end, what you have is people doing jobs like, what, how do we provide drinking water to our country, who maybe don't care about it, who do not have the knowledge to do that. And this is bad.
Yeah, there was a lovely quote that Mark said near the end when he was talking about access to clean water. And he said that failure to have access to clean water removes a lot of people's dignity, and it puts societies in a very desperate situation. And yeah, I thought that was a very powerful quote for him. And after he told the story at the end about visiting his hometown and seeing the desperateness of the situation, he talked about one of his friends in the savings club, and he said, what he said was, his passion and his drive and his expertise in this field really drove the rest of us and gave us confidence that we can actually do something. So I guess this is what you're saying about not just getting your friends. I mean, he was his friend, but the main thing that they got together and they got on board was the passion and the drive and the expertise. And I wanted to pick up on this point because I feel that surrounding yourself with the right people is crucial in achieving certain audacious goals or doing some of the audacious work that the world needs. So when you're talking about your own personal goals, for example, then yes, the responsibility is primarily yours to set them and see them through. But larger goals, which involve more resources, call for collaboration, and choosing the right people to work with is crucial in that regard, not only because of their knowledge and skills and maybe financial support, but also, like Mark said, the passion and drive of your co-workers and, of course, the ability to work collaboratively as a team. And you picked up on something in last week's episode, Maribel, where our previous guest, Debbie, had talked about projects in the UX industry failing because people's egos got in the way. And when Mark was talking, it sounded to me as if egos are not getting in the way with this project. Would you agree with that? Absolutely.
Of course. Of course. This is such, we could say that this is the least egoistic project that I have heard of, because these young men who have decent jobs, but he mentioned himself, it's not like any one of them is rich or whatever. They are using their own savings to provide for the public. And that's amazing. That's one part. And the other one is they are not expecting some huge revenue. So the motivation for doing this is absolutely an intrinsic one, something that is for them fulfilling, and what they're expecting to is to, you know, just maybe get what they invested back. And I thought one of his sentences was so beautiful, that he said, the best would be that the project is not needed anymore, and then they can stop, because then that would mean the government, who should be taking care of that, is doing it.
Exactly. And that was actually a question which came up for me, but we didn't have time to ask it in the 30-minute interview, which we were restricting ourselves to. And so when we finished the formal interview, Mark stayed on the line and I asked him the question about why he chose to go that route and why he didn't lobby the state in order for them to provide the service that they should be providing. So we had another few minutes of conversation with Mark after that, in which he answered my question, and we'll listen to that now. I've got another question which is coming up, which we didn't have time for in the thing. And that is, because, I mean, you talked about that it's NGOs and it's the state that should be providing this service. It's a public service, public utilities. What was it that made you decide to do this as a private enterprise and not to lobby the state, not to go on the political route and lobby the state in order for them to provide the service that they should be providing?
The need to get water to people.
The urgency of it.
The urgency of the
matter. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because going that route can open up access to greater funds, And, you know, if you lobby NGOs and you get buy-in from a lot of people, they can put in funds in there. We did do that initially. As I said, there were many iterations to this before we ended up here. And we went into corporates and we spoke with them and gave them the opportunity to take this from us and use it as their CSI initiative, where we would run it for them, but it would be their branding, their product, and their marketing that they would be getting out of it. And while they were all willing to sit with us and talk to us, nobody was ever really willing to say, okay, then let's do it. And that's where we found value in the guys at Puma Petroleum who managed to chat with us. And they were very forthcoming. They couldn't give us any financial assistance, but then they could help us with access to their forecourts. So we knew that then we would have a location that's secure, that's open 24 hours a day. And there are multiple locations like this throughout the country. So should we then find an investor or funds that would enable us to expand throughout the country, you know, Puma Petroleum would be where we'd base almost all of our kiosks. And we also had numerous conversations with local authorities, you know, councillors and headmasters and members of parliament, and they really wanted this product in their community because they felt that their communities were being held back by not having dependable access. Because this is really an issue that affects the middle income communities. Because the high-income communities can afford to drill an 80-meter borehole and have full access to water at their houses. So even if nothing is coming in from the municipality, their lives don't change that much. You know, it's a minor inconvenience of looking for a provider to drill a borehole for you and then pipe that into the house. But you will have a flushing toilet at the end of the day. And then on the other end of the scale, NGOs were available. Like I said, in the community that we are operating in, there is an operation that was donated by Medicine Sans Frontiers, which gives access to people water for 15 Zim dollars a month, which is nothing in comparison to the value that they're creating. But the issue was that it wasn't viable for people who go to work or, you know, who want a certain taste level of their water. And so what we did was we created a 24-hour access and we put in treating chemicals in our water, and we put in carbon filters to ensure that our taste, the water always came out crisp and good. And what we have found, because whenever we onboard a new customer, and we give them their first 5 liters, and we give them 80 liters for free, you know, just on onboarding. What they always say is they can't believe the taste and the quality of the water. And that's something that we want to maintain. It's, yeah, you should enjoy drinking water. You know, it shouldn't be, it shouldn't be something that you think about three times. Do I really want to have this water? You know, I'm dying of thirst, but this is what it is. And yeah, that's the journey we've taken and how we've ended up as a private enterprise, because we couldn't get the buy-in from the corporates that we sought. And the governmental route is fraught with challenges. It's, you know, the red tape to get from, well, seeing somebody in the first place and then actually putting something on site, it's a terribly long process that can take in excess of 5 years to get everything done. Mm-hmm. And that then defeats the urgency of the matter. So then we just took the route that we were led basically, because it wasn't our first choice. So yeah, we, I think this goes down to the fact that we're not saints, we're not saviors, we're just some people who thought they could do something and tried, and where we are now is where we ended up. Not because we didn't explore other options, but because this was the one that we could make work.
Yeah. It's fantastic work.
I think it's a fantastic example, regardless of the size of what you're trying to do. It is important. And I hope that in Zimbabwe, it makes municipality and governments ashamed and get them doing something that should be part of their job description.
Yeah, well, we pray, and I'm sure it will come right.
Yeah, I've been sipping water all the way through this, and you know, I couldn't imagine, you know, like you say, not having a glass of water and not enjoying it, and not thinking, oh, I don't want to touch that thing that's coming out of my tap, or that I have to go down, walk miles to get. You know, it's just so far removed from where I am. I just can't even imagine it.
One of my colleagues once, you know, when we were discussing this thing, told me that putting something out there that's good is magnitudes better than launching a perfect product, years down the road. And that's what we've tried to do. And you find that the lessons that you learn from customers, no manner of modeling can give you those insights. You know, when somebody comes to you and says, but this actually doesn't work for me. Why, have you ever thought about doing it this way? That is definitely one of the things that drives our innovation. And it's because we have something on the ground. You know, I pray, and you know, we all pray that, you know, somebody will see our product and say, can we get these guys to come in? We will fund them to bring water to our community. On the flip side, you've got, people always say, just do it, you know, when it comes to things. And it's a pearl of wisdom that is banded about a lot in sports and self-improvement circles. And it works there. It's done wonders for them. And it's sort of found its way as being a staple for entrepreneurs seeking to start something, you know, anything. But we found that bravado will never replace the hard work of market research and product development and strategy development. Because if you don't have a sound base, you know, your entrepreneurial journey is going to be short. It doesn't matter how brilliantly it starts. It will be short in spite of you having started. So it's not just do it. I say, you know, start.
Yeah.
Start
on the right foot. Make sure you have a sound base. Exactly.
Yeah, be on a sure foundation.
Yeah.
The walls are for show anyway. Yeah. But I think I've taken up so much more of the time that you've set aside for this.
No, that's fine. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to you, Mark. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Enjoyed it.
Taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, thank you, guys.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of our podcast, Audaciousness. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. A huge thanks to Mark for sharing his heartfelt and very personal story with us. I was moved all the way, and even now talking about it was, again, I think the work that he and his colleagues and friends are doing is absolutely necessary.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give it a like. And if you think someone else would benefit from listening to this conversation, please pass it on to them. Share it with your friends, your family, your colleagues. And if you know of any other audacious people, including yourself, please get in touch, as we'd love to speak to you.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with another audacious person and another audacious episode.
And a reminder too that in 3 weeks, on the 11th of August, we're holding our first Audaciousness Book Club. If you're interested in reading a book about people who have set themselves audacious goals and then discussing their stories with other audacious people, then please come and join us. The link to that is in the show notes.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.